Hi there, we are James and Dan, two fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Darling, look at this scene in my crystal ball.
The captain's looking well. Wait a minute, I remember this.
But it hasn't happened yet. It's a vision of what's to come.
Well, when it does happen, I expect it to be exactly the way I remember it.
Well, aren't you full of faith in the fates?
Oh, I have faith, madam. In you.
George frowned and climbed into bed beside his wife in a terse and terrible mood. His wife, sitting upright, lowered her eyes and pursed her lips with slight frustration and pity for his jumbled mind. "What is it now, my love?" she softly asked, shifting the covers to make a welcome space in the bed for him. George roughly fluffed his pillow and growled.
"That blasted library's on the docket tomorrow. That woman wants the town's approval to hold some sort of sale or something. At night. Who the hell holds a sale at night, Maddie? Who?"
Before she could answer,
"Weirdo people with moldy old books they don't want. That's who,"
George snapped. Matilda calmly placed her feather bookmark between the pages she was reading, closed her book, and turned it face down on the bed, and lifted a cup of lavender-tinted tea from her bedside table. She peered through the rising curls of steam at her husband, offering him a sip from the delicate cup.
I don't care for the tea, Maddie,"
mumbled George, unable to break away from his aging bride's gaze. Time seemed to stop in the quiet, cozy bedroom. The aromatic cup of tea held still in the air between the long married couple. Matilda's lips gently curved into a small, warm smile. The flame from her bedside candle glinted off the star-shaped gilded seal on the back of her closed book and lodged its glow in the dim well of her beautiful dark eyes.
"Well, maybe just a sip, then,"
said George, taking the cup from her hand. On a moonless fall night, across from the depths of Phantom Forest, on a risen hill, the Midnight Library sits embedded in the ground, looking as though it grew there. A line of orange dancing torch flames, equally spaced apart, silently dot the building's perimeter, each reflecting an amber luster on the black and mossy stones of the rambling structure. Each ball of crackling fire is held aloft and still by a meaty and emotionless goon. Dozens of them, standing in place, one after the other, lining the boundary and disappearing around the sweeping walls of the darkened library. At the back of the Gothic home, high in an upper room, somewhere beyond the steepled balconies, Miranda Merrick lies recumbent behind pendless velveteen drapes of a vintage canopied bed, her flesh and spirit rapidly trading places in a nebulous blur. Miranda works as she sleeps. She's visited at least two uncertain guests this night, and imparted a personal message to each of them within their nighttime dreams, each of them near a shore. To one dreamer, she appeared on a windswept beach as a beloved silver mare they were fond of as a child, their own face mirrored back to them in the animal's damp and soulful eyes. To the other, she shone brightly as the glinting checks of sunlight on a rolling golden surf as they walked the shore with a long-dead loved one. By morning, each uncertain guest would wake with sympathy and an unexplained acceptance of everyone and everything in the Midnight Library, even without knowing for sure what they might be. Just before the rising of the morning star, Miranda herself then fell deeply into a dream of her own. She saw the setting salmon-colored sun as it sank beneath hazy navy waves. She watched as her two guests mounted the silver mare, then melted into streaks in mid-air and were absorbed into the still warm sand. The loved one, now a rotted corpse with a fleet of changing faces dappling across its skull, turned to her and offered her its fleshless hand. Each patch of face, no matter how small, was familiar to her in its brief and fading flash. A heaving, breathing fire burst into being before Miranda and her corpse companion, and they began to waltz around it. Up from the smoldering ashes of the snapping flames rose three burning women, and she knew their names. One was Mary, one was Margaret, and the other one was Jane. Three maternal grandmothers from beyond the grave. They chanted,
"Look here, daughter, and obey. See the future turn your way. You must do what we could not. Turn this village with our plot."
Never in all of her years, as many times as she tried, no matter how deeply into trance she dared go, Miranda never had the gift of pyromancy. Until now. There in the fire, she saw what should be, if only she could make it so. Irma watched her witch mother shivering in the sleeping fit she couldn't seem to wake from. The small, worried demon hunched upon the pillow and placed her fiery hand upon Miranda's icy brow, the chilled beads of sweat sizzling into steam. In the tiny meeting room of the village city hall, George banged his brass-ringed gavel sternly, requesting that
everyone please take the next order of business seriously.
He thought he recalled sleeping rather deeply after a sip of his wife's tea. He certainly remembered dreaming, but all of the morning's clamor had washed it all away. To everyone's surprise, perhaps more than 50 people had shown up to vote on this one unusual issue. Simple printed ballots were handed out to both those seated and those left standing in the small room. The permit requested could not have been simpler. Each folded in half ballot was printed with a single sentence that read, "Regarding the Midnight Library's permit to hold a midnight market on the city line," with no explanation as to what a midnight market even was. Below this sentence, two square boxes appeared for the voters to indicate their choice. One marked, "I approve," and the other marked, "I do not approve." George reminded the townspeople that this request was highly unusual, certainly unnecessary, and possibly dangerous. Some nodded in agreement, and some did not. The unspoken entity in the room, the thing everyone knew but no one would dare say out loud, was that the small crowd was almost perfectly divided. There were those who regularly attended the readings and gatherings at the Midnight Library, and those who wouldn't dream of it. These two opposing camps were sometimes living in the same house together. The other glaringly obvious thing that stood out to everyone in attendance for the vote? Not a single soul from the Midnight Library had turned up to the meeting, but their oppositionists were out in force. Members of the clergy stood together, and parishioners dressed in frumpy clothing, wearing stern faces to match. Father Finney seemed to be babysitting several nuns, especially Sister Trixie, who was hoping to catch a glimpse of John Darling. There were also at least a dozen nondescript folks with one little item in common. Each wore a tiny lapel pin with a black pointed witch's hat on it, with a bright red circle around it, and a line diagonally crossing the hat. It was easy to guess how they would vote. But there were others, those fringe people, those shifty, artsy, bookish types, the ones who won't be told, loners and free thinkers. Lydia, the letter carrier, stood dressed head to toe in black. Perhaps the entire staff of Grimm's Grocers, apparently given time off to be there. There were also the rugged women who owned the bed and breakfast that were rumored to be grave diggers, and the die-hard visitors. Those who dared to park in the field and trek through the forest, to pass through the graveyard to enter the library that was somehow a home, and to sit in the glorious reading room with the rumored witch as she told her tales. They were all sad that Miranda wasn't there. "I'll hold her feet," said Alice. "No, don't," Natasha quickly insisted as she bounded across the room. "They have to walk. Let them walk." "Can she speak?" asked the wide-eyed laundry maid, shaking her head and rephrasing. "Can they speak?"
"Be quiet,"
barked John Darling. More man than wolf just now. The heavy damask curtains of the circular seance room had been haphazardly thrown closed, the antique table and chairs removed. Glowing black pillar candles on tall wrought iron spikes replaced the light of day. In this, the turret room, where Miranda had begun to change.
Bang, bang, bang!
George smacked his gavel again on his well-worn desk.
"Let's get this silly thing over with,"
he muttered, as a clerk began to gather the two heaping stacks of folded votes tossed into piles on the desk. It was clear to everyone in the warm little room that the vote was going to be close. Slow blinks, sideways glances, and quiet snorts of derision were present from both sides as each of the voters marked their chosen X's and made their way to the desk and dropped their votes into two distinct piles. You nearly puncture the paper as you vote with great love for the library's cause, whatever it is. Father Finney, with his glasses down the tip of his nose, lifted his head to try to make sure that Sister Trixie was voting the right way. Perceiving his prying eyes, the young nun quickly looked up and exclaimed, "Is that Miss Mary coming in?" Causing the old priest's head to snap upright and his eyes to eagerly search the room, giving her the split second she needed to vote that she approved. Lydia boldly wrinkled her nose at George as she set her vote in the obvious "I approve" stack. He ignored her.
"We'll have your results tomorrow,"
he grumbled.
"Tomorrow? What's wrong with today, George? You want it in surgery?"
complained Big Lou. Only the approvers laughed. The clerk had neatened the two stacks of ballots, which seemed to be the exact same height. George frowned. A shaft of sunlight split the room as the rear door of the little town hall creaked open, and George's wife Matilda peered in and waved a cheery hello to everyone inside. She held the door wide open from the outside and looked back down the walkway, courteously waiting. "Hello, ladies," she brightly said. Always willing to help, Matilda was.
"You suck. You suck.
Miranda, in a black nightgown with her hair unkempt and one eye open, wobbled as she double-step walked around the candle-lit room, floating about 6 inches off the floor. The wolf pups whimpered, and Irma, perched on the marble mantel, chewed her yellow nails as she watched her mother deep in the work of her enchantment. Mr. Darling guarded the witch with one large tan hand on her shoulder, and the other poised to brace her if needed. Two enslaved skeletons stood with their bony backs against the dark purple flocked walls, bearing serving trays in their pure white skeletal hands. As the witch prepared to speak, Natasha snatched a bundle of henbane from one of the trays, tilted it into the flame of a candle, and made a circle of smoke with it that drifted behind Miranda's head. A pair of unconscious voices loomed from the witch's open mouth. "Good morning, Miss Matilda," said the ladies in unison. "We hope we're not too late." "Oh, it's really just a simple thing, ladies, but we certainly want your votes." Matilda beamed at the two white-haired women and noticed their no witches lapel pins as they passed through the open door. She absolutely remembered seeing the women at a reading. Matilda placed a quick hand over her giggle. Miranda wiggled her fingers in the air, then said,
Thank you.
In two disembodied voices. Natasha swiftly handed her the juniper pencil from one of the skeleton's trays. The witch raised the green stick to write. The two ladies thanked the clerk in unison for their ballots and tiny pencils, then stood with the pencils hovering over their opened votes cupped in their opposing hands. The witch slightly wavered off the ground, making two X's in mid-air. The juniper pencil then fell to the hardwood floor.
"Why, let me take those up for you, ladies,"
said a smiling Stephen Strangeways, his eyes seeing a familiar glint in theirs before they mechanically walked away. Matilda quickly marked her vote while smiling at her husband. She handed it in and winked at him, causing him to shift uncomfortably in his seat. George bumped the table, tipping one stack of votes into the other, mixing them together. "Oops!" she giggled as she sailed back across the crowded little room and out the single door, taking the sunshine with her. A thick purple mist began descending in the evening, with a rosy glow close to the ground. It settled onto the rooftops and wandered in through the windows of the sleepy village town. You, the entire village, and all of its people, and even its animals, became dull and dozy early in the evening, falling into an irresistible abyss of sleep. But the midnight library ramped up into motion. There were busy maids packing and kitchen staff rattling, and Mr. Darling overseeing the hustle. making sharp little checks in his book. But there was less to be hauled than you'd think. A lonely, overgrown trail at the back of the mansion had been freshly cleared and paved with fine river rocks. The secret path wasn't a road, really, at least not one that anyone in the town knew of for certain. But two distinct parallel wheel trails were now clearly reinstated. Beneath the fresh layer of river rocks, centuries of wagon wheel ruts lay as the first record of the Snaky Path's use. The townspeople always wondered how those in the library seemed to arrive so abruptly in the village. The meandering track led from a gated outbuilding on the far grounds of the library, across a bramble-filled field, and into Phantom Forest. From overhead, some could see where it broke and branched and twisted, crossing only a single stream before suddenly dumping out of a dense row of pines onto an actual road that led to the village. The Witch of the Manor watched as her filigreed hourglass emptied its top gleaming chamber of sparkly onyx sand. In through the window flew Professor Steerpike, with a folded page grasped in his beak. He dropped the letter in the center of her desk. Miranda smiled and patted the crow, greeting him like the timeless friend that he was. She lifted a delicate glass cloche that covered an ornate brass pot, raising her dark brows at the iridescent bird. In a single hop, the professor dropped beside the petite pot and poked his yellow beak down inside. He flapped his shimmery wings with delight and whizzed back out the window with an azure blue eye as his treat. In the cool, looming dusk, a light rumble and jingle rose up as the bold team of horses and trap rolled on to the grounds, making soft whinnies and snorts as they halted. Each of the enigmatic beasts paired side by side and linked in tandem, were all fitted with new leather tack. Each rich saddle and bridle was embedded with burnished brass conchos of ringed little stars, and what looked like a gentle strike of scrollwork upon each little ring, but was too small and too charming for most human eyes to perceive, was the inlaid signature of the craftsman, Stephen Strangeways. From each gathered point in the leather, along each horse's noble head and body, were hung tiny, lustrous brass bells. With a quick sliding pass of her pointed fingernail, the witch broke the crimson seal on the vellum. The heading writ large in a bygone old font that waved its way across the top of the bill read, "The Far, Far East Trading Company." In a smaller version of the same font, "Bringing the past to life for your pleasure." And in a still smaller, more serious font, "Serving supernatural clients only. Mortals need never apply and or may be punished for doing so." Miranda laughed to herself and signed her name on the scrawled line by the word "payee" on the bill. Then, with no emotion at all. She pierced the pulp of her forefinger with the needle-sharp tip of her pen, letting a full drop of her inky blood splat to the parchment, then folded it neatly into a small square. She walked to the open leaded glass window for a moment, pausing to gaze at the purple haze hanging over the village. But she could see Mr. Darling clearly because of the blood tattoo on the inside of his ear. She watched him working away. She had long wanted to do something special for him, her lifelong companion. Snapping herself out of her thoughts, she clapped her hands 3 times, saying,
"Hear me, Ratten Konig. A servant is needed at hand."
In only a moment, the scratching sound of scurrying traveled up the stony wall to the ebony sill of the window, and in popped a hurried and hairy white rat with a messenger bag on his back, his beady red eyes staring up. The witch's heart warmed as she leaned down and asked, "Oh, what's your name, Sugar Booger?"
Sugar. Full stop, please, ma'am.
The little rat whispered in earnest, twanging his white whiskers with his soft pink hands. Miranda neatly tucked the shipping bill into the small courier sack of the wee murine being. She thanked him and patted him gently on his head. Without a single concern, Sugar, the white rat, leapt out of the window. Mr. Darling glanced at his pocket watch and removed a weighty skeleton key from his breast pocket, deftly unlocking the heavy black padlock that hung on the high-arched wooden doors of the rear lot's outbuilding. Muffled laughter and a flurry of fumbling noises flowed out of the doors as they creaked open in the dim dusk of the evening. The fair light crept in and exposed a broad, tarp-covered shape. Lightning quick, the creatures invisibly tugged at the huge canvas ship sail until it slid off and slumped to the straw-covered floor, revealing an immaculate gypsy caravan. More sinister giggles came as the unseen beasties moved the carriage forward from behind, pushing it outside into the light lavender fog. The enchanting caravan was a sight to see. Hundreds of years old, it looked as though it were brand new. Along each glossy, mulberry-colored side, it was covered in hand-painted gilded stars, roses, and crescent moons. A soft, golden light glowed from its 6 draped windows, complete with window boxes blooming with moonflowers and nightshade. A lapis-blue raised compartment on the roof was lined with 6 more smaller versions of the lower windows. From these emanated faint music and the scent of cinnamon. A plump, green upholstered bench seat with brass buttons spanned the front of the fetching old-world wagon, and the inside was a luxury suite of dark cherry wood, lattice-glassed windowed cabinets, and indigo velvet couches strewn with copper-colored overstuffed pillows shaped like stars and moons. A troop of fleeing maids and several footmen trundled back inside the library as Darling turned and locked the massive front door. Natasha, in a new forest green gown, waved an all's well signal from the seat of the caravan. that had been hitched to the team of the six majestic horses. Darling placed his black patent shoe into the sidestep of the wagon and pulled himself up onto the seat beside Natasha. Irma sat grinning between them in a comical zip-up onesie, with rounded ears sewn onto the hood, resembling some manner of harmless mouse. The little gypsy wagon, with Ramona the ram-headed girl inside, held only a half dozen large crates of goods. Night fell. Across the sprawling forest, the village slept, mostly. George was lying disgruntled in his sleep. Matilda was dressed and ready to go. Darling let out a commanding yip, and the sleek team of horses intuitively pulled the fancy wagon onto the old trail and headed in to Phantom Forest. Only a warm strip of magenta remained in the sky now, as the dark came bearing down. But Phantom Forest had lights of its own. The fireflies rose as the wagon rode by, their tiny bright lights rising up. And since this path was unknown to the visitors, it led past places they would never see. Glowing lanterns of several huts and houses hung here and there in the distance, and the forest floor shone with noctilucent flowers. As the jingling wagon rolled along, others began to join them on the trail, a few on horseback or pulling a wagon of their own. Some walked along carrying goods in crates or sacks. Most of them looked, almost, like any other person you might see. But there was something different about them. The traveling company rolled along with voices, music, and laughter as they went. In the treetops, large, slow-flapping wings could be heard. A young man running alongside of the caravan called up to Mr. Darling.
Mr. Darling, where's to be our patch, sir? Where are we allowed to be?
We'll back up near the river on the county line. You'll see.
Darling called down in a reassuring voice. The cheerful procession of motley characters with all of their goods in tow followed the library's lead wagon past a dense copse of trees to their left, with a distinct corner border to them. The fanciful wagon turned by the corner off of the path and into a clearing, a flat, narrow field of low-growing clover. The pretty field was framed in an L shape by the thick trees along one side and an adjoining row of sparse trees where Mr. Darling instructed the merchants to camp in a line. Behind the thin row of trees ran a slow river. At the open end of the rectangular clover lot was posted a simple engraved sign with four words in pale glowing paint. It read, "Welcome to the village." Miranda, standing before her dressing mirror, tilted her head with a look of contentment on her face. Her lady's maid, Della, opened the tall scroll-work doors of a huge mahogany armoire and lifted the center black hat from its form. The witch drew the brocade laces of her satin bodice a little more snugly before donning the neat pointed hat. Della, peering into the glass alongside of her mistress, smiled and nodded, and the witch smiled back at her maid. In the growing darkness, Darlin steered the team of horses and whimsical wagon to park alongside the dense backing of trees at a right angle from all of the others. The curious trees, for some reason, long ago, had been planted impossibly close together. They were mostly pines and sugar maples, but placed so closely that they grew bonded to each other in groups of threes, forming a kind of wooden wall with barely enough room for a very slim person to pass through the gaps. In the heart of the village, all nestled in purple fog, the clock tower tolled 10 soft notes, and the people stayed still in their sleep. Along the river, the running water became softer in its sound, and a far-off bell clanged quietly, its sound making its way through the heavy woods. The colorful band of forest dwellers spread out in the field. In all, there might have been 20 of them, each person or group taking a spot beside another. With their backs to the sound of the river, they unpacked their small carts and set their goods on the ground, filling the narrow strip of field with their chatter and the clatter of their work. Across the way stood the lone gypsy wagon, its team of horses still hitched, the length of the two combined blocking a large portion of the wall of trees. Mr. Darling leapt down in a single bound and quickly turned back to catch little Irma, who had sprung from her seat with excitement. He firmly sat the demon woman child on the saddle of the nearest horse and pointed his tan finger in her ornery face, and spoke only one word, saying,
"Stay."
Her impish eyes twinkled as she hissed at him. A puff of foul yellow gas was her breath. He doffed his top hat and returned to the carriage, his ears now wolfen and tall, twitching to listen to the sounds in the night air. Natasha had already disappeared through the decorative curtains behind the driver's bench and begun shifting crates to the rear of the wagon. Ramona eagerly working with her friend. Three vintage brooms hovered 3 feet off the floor in Miranda's private quarters. She quickly peered into a low bowl of quicksilver-like fluid and chose the middle broom. Sitting side-saddled upon the wooden handle, Della down-turned the center iron handles of the leaded glass windows and cast them outward with ease. And the witch flew out the window. Along the sparse trees, the gentle forest dwellers had set out their wares on blankets and overturned crates, doing the best that they could. But high overhead, as the night became late, a stirring was heard in the woods. On the west side of the village, on the port side of town, the thick purple mist grew thicker along the shores of the bay, creeping slowly through the fog, came the figurehead of the great ship, the Mystique. Its haunting bell, now more clear to the ear. A silhouette of sailors gathered on the bow and began hoisting planks over the side. Tied together end to end, the floating gangway reached the beach in seconds. The ship sat waiting in the darkness, with not a single soul on the shore. The sailors all waiting, straining their eyes to see. One with a spyglass saw the little white shape moving, disturbing the blue iridescent sand.
"Here it comes!"
shouted the spying man. High above the violet haze that hung over the village, Miranda encircled the scene. She glanced down at the quiet town and drifted out to the woods over the meager encampment before glimpsing the ship in the bay. In the distance, all around her, odd shapes glided in the air. She didn't know how to control them. The lone white rat scrambled onto the sandy plank, shifting the waxy green bag on his back. He climbed upward, trying not to think just how high the wobbly boards went. When he reached the top timber, the spyglass sailor held out a yellow lantern over the bow and welcomed the rat into his rough weathered palm. Sugar raised his pink hand in a serious salute and whispered,
"May I please see your captain, sir?"
Spindling down through the fog and alighting beside the gypsy caravan, the witch grinned at Irma, who squealed and jumped up. Miranda wagged her finger at the little demon.
You stay where Mr. Darling has put you,
she commanded, and the demon sat down in a huff. The witch crossed the clover field to greet the forest dwellers. Two women, dressed in plain dresses, almost like peasants, approached her. One quietly asked, "Do you think we've brought enough?" Miranda smiled, saying loudly enough for the others to hear, "This is perfect, my lovelies. Don't worry. We'll fill it out in a flash." In the village, the sleepers stirred. And you slightly shift and dream.
Well, my dear guest, thank you so much for joining us for part one of the Midnight Market. Part two will be our next reading. We apologize for having to split the reading into two, but it's just so powerful, you see. It's basically three readings long. However, if you are anxious to get to the unpredictable second half before October 29th, The Midnight Market is available now in its entirety in Patreon. For as little as $5, you can help the Midnight Library get a welcome letter, stickers, and an official bookmark in the mail, and get access to countless hours of extra content and postings. If you turn on your notifications in settings, you and I can get in touch with each other. I would love to hear from you. Good night, my spooky lovely. Good night.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.